It's ad break time. I'm pleased to announce that the Beyond Solitaire podcast remains proudly sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning through Games and Simulations. This week, I have a very special announcement, which is that I will once again be teaching a class for their certificate in applied game design. Come take Using Games to Teach What You Can Convey Through Play with yours truly. The class runs from January 22nd to February 29th, and I would love to see you there. A link to the registration page is in the show notes. CLGS's latest game, 500-Year-Old Vampire, just finished a very successful campaign, but if you forgot to back it, you can now pre-order through BackerKit. The link is also in the show notes. I also want to plug my own Patreon. Your support means a lot to me, both emotionally and financially. Patreon money is what makes it possible to keep improving my channel by upgrading the equipment, and I'm also hoping to increase the amount of videos I can publish over the course of the next year. If you want to help out, head over to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. For now, though, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week on the podcast, I have a very special guest. This is Dr. Jenny Cromwell. She is a reader in ancient history at Manchester Metropolitan University. Did I get the university right?
Yes, that's the right one.
But Jenny, ancient history kind of covers over the fact that you are an Egyptologist. So tell the people what you do.
Yeah, so my background's in, I guess, famous Egyptology, you know, pharaohs, what people think of when they think of ancient Egypt, but I specialized from the end of my undergraduate and through postgraduate in Coptic studies, so the last form of the indigenous Egyptian language. And my non-gaming research specialty is in early Islamic Egypt, so 7th and 8th centuries AD / CE, depending on what system you use. And I'm interested in just the boring bits of daily life, what people did, as mundane or as exciting as it gets. I'm basically the person who snoops through the mail bins 1300 years later and sees what your receipts were and what you were doing and what postcards you've thrown out. So yeah, I'm interested in all kinds of stuff: language, use, interactions with people, economy, what people did, education, yeah, a whole gamut of things.
Fantastic. And so for those of you out there, Jenny and I have crossed paths a couple times over the years. But I think this is probably the longest conversation that we've had.
Like, probably conferences are not a good place for actually talking to people, as opposed to like a hello across a coffee with mutual friends.
But just so people can enjoy this a bit more, when you talk about trash, you do mean literal trash in many cases, yes?
Yeah, stuff that gets chucked out is not anything important. People normally take with them or try and deposit somewhere. But then there's all the other stuff that people just throw out. And Egypt's great because it preserves so much organic stuff and stuff that absolutely perishes in all wetter climates. So yeah, archaeologists may call them trash heaps, throwouts, which is maybe a little bit nicer, more sanitized than trash heaps, but or just heaps. But yeah, everything, sometimes stuff that's left in houses, but we have so little of that. So yeah, stuff that gets chucked on the edge of the desert and just stays there till white Egyptologists come along and take it out of Egypt.
So just so you know, everyone, that receipt that you threw away from the grocery store or whatever could someday be very meaningful. I think my favorite papyrology story is just that the one that was used as toilet paper, I think it's like a bit of the Iliad or something like that.
Yeah, of some Oxyrhynchus, and the boring dude or the bored doodles that people do in it, or the crude little one, like little anecdotes. There's a famous Oxyrhynchus one which has an image of a gentleman bent over, which reflects a passage in the text.
So just so y'all know, this is not your kids' Latin class. I don't get to do this at work. But one way in which our paths have crossed that, you know, we're now discovering is that we both absolutely love board games. So is that something that you always liked and we just never talked about it? Or is it something that came to you recently?
It's something recent. So growing up, I don't have an anti-board game family, but I have, like, I guess, a really traditional minimalist, like, play Monopoly for an hour till you've lost all will to live. Like party games, Jenga, Uno, like some small things. It was only when, so I had one postdoc position in Denmark in Copenhagen. I had housemates who were Belgian and German, and they were all into board games in ways that I could never like comprehend. It's like, what are all these board games and going to board game cafes? Because I was always a video game person. Grew up, like my dad was a video game guy and he's still a video game guy. And so I grew up digital and board games weren't a part of it. But the genesis or the road to, I guess genesis is the right word, but the road to board games started when I joined Manchester Met in 2018. I'd given, at least I'd done a little something, I guess, as a lot of Egypt video game people, 2017 was a big year in terms of Assassin's Creed Origins came out and like Egypt made a big splash. And it, that was kind of coincided with a rise or the ongoing then rise in interest in historical video games, ancient historical video games. So word got around, I was interested in games, and the co-director of what was then the Manchester Met Games Network, it's gone through a few iterations, found out, and he we had a chat. And so I suddenly discovered this other pool of academics that are interested in games, like seriously, not just for fun, and who weren't in game studies. So whether they're in English, in sociology, in the Faculty of Arts and Humanities, in arts, and then also we go across the faculty, so in maths in terms of programming and game design and education, and all these people came together and it legitimized suddenly my very long kind of side interest in predominantly video games. But the then two directors, so and now the current directors, Paul Wake and Chloe Germain, are board game people. They are analog. They have been writing, making games, writing academically, you know, all of this. Chloe's into LARPs, which is an acronym I'd never heard of. I knew RPG, but LARP was entirely new. Paul is, he also runs a unit where English students write narratives, I think, for board games, or at least work with designers. And suddenly this whole massive world of board games opened up. So it took me down routes and tangents that I never thought I would go down. And they, late 2019, they started chats with Asmodee, the French games publisher, distributor, and they got funding to do a project on eco board games and talking about climate change and climate crisis and working with secondary school. So I think predominantly 12 to 15, 16 year olds. And it all snowballed from there. And I was thinking, suddenly games is not just interest in reception studies, but pedagogy as well. So now it's kind of blossomed into all different paths of games as the study of reception. So how ancient Egypt is represented in board games, as well as video games, and working on both. Games as potential use in the classroom. I'm hopefully starting work with primary school kids, because my sister's a primary school teacher as well, which helps. And ways to supplement, because Egypt is taught normally to like 7 to 9 year olds in the UK primary school system. And so as a way to support teaching and learning and non-traditional forms of learning to get them thinking in different ways and creatively. And as the final gaming one for 3 years now, on an ad hoc basis, I've been part of a RPG historical gaming crew called Dice on the Nile, where we explore 8th century Egyptian history through, maybe controversially for some, Dungeons and Dragons 5th edition rule set. And so, yeah, different ways that games have now entered my life and become like a really fundamental part of not just interest, but also research.
Oh man, that's so awesome. So are you doing a research project now that is specific to Egypt and games reception?
So I am currently finishing off an edited book called Ancient Egypt and Video Games, which when it's done, I will send to De Gruyter for the Video Games and Humanities series. And that's very near manuscript completion for pre-review. And that's been cool, especially because like the kind of interest in video games that I have compared to others are a really broad range and learning so much. I actually just bought Death Stranding because one of the papers is on Death Stranding. And I never thought, one, I'd ever play a Hideo Kojima game, but also I had no clue that like an Egyptian concept was integral to the story. And so all kinds of games. So that's working its way to fruition. And this year I've given a number of papers on reception in board games. And that's the next bigger project I want to do. Originally it was going to be reception, public history, and education. But education is not my wheelhouse, right? And it requires something much more serious and through people who work in the education sector to do properly. And it's certainly not me to be leading, but as part of a team. But yeah, board games is reception and public history. And so I've been, yeah, playing with ideas. I gave a couple of papers at conferences this year and just figuring out like the angles and where to go and how much is out there. And ideally I want to see and touch, if not play, every game that I talk about as well. So it's a much longer process than maybe some people would think.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. And Egypt does show up in a surprising number of games. Like actually, I did not expect to see Egypt in the Forgotten City, which I just finished on my
list. Oh, do I have to add something else to my list now?
You do, but I got all four endings in like 8 hours, so you'll be okay.
Cool. 8 hours. That's good to know.
You fall into the ground and you are in another time, like you're in a Roman city.
Yeah.
But there are relationships with Greeks and with Egyptians that get explored a bit in the game. This is what I love.
Also, accidental discovery of Egypt in games, like games which aren't billed as historical in any way, but Egypt appears not even named as Egypt, right? But it becomes a trope. If you have a desert level, you have pyramids, you have cat statues, you have very orientalizing, Easternized figures like bad guys in turbans or anything. You have monsters which are maybe sphinxes or scarabs. So there's a game, a little independent game that came out, I think sometime last year, I think is a 22 game called Soldiers, written S-O-U-L, just. And the desert level is Egypt. There's a pyramid. Anubis is like the ultimate bad guy of that level. As you get there, there's just all these giant cat statues that you pass. And it's like, this is just quintessentially Egypt. It's not called that in the game. The game world is absolutely fictitious, but it's Egypt by any other name. And how that shared ideal, this public conception of what Egypt is, and that it's a world building. There was this great quote, I forget who said it, it's in a volume called Historia Ludens, and there's one line about why World War II games are so popular. It becomes like Marvel or DC, but without copyright, because everyone knows that world or has an idea of it. And so I like really just finding all these surprising, non-advertised as such, little Egyptian worlds and games.
That's really funny because I think a lot of the same things about Rome, but I feel like with Egypt, I feel like the answer to this is obvious, but I want to ask it anyway. What are the tropes that you typically see? And I guess, what does that mean for what we're remembering about Egypt and how do we push it?
Yeah, it's exactly these questions that I'm interested in. The big ones are sand, pyramids, animal-headed gods, cats, often or invariably cats. And there are a few other things like the Sphinx, but then the Sphinx also gets conflated with the Sphinx of Greek mythology and the riddles. And And so, but yeah, as soon as you've got sand, you've got pyramids, it becomes gold. Like the color scheme becomes very Egyptian-esque. One thing that is always associated is camels, which is not historically accurate. Like, I hate the word historical accuracy as well. Like, I think like moved on, there's way more interesting things to talk about than accuracy. But camels are so closely associated with Egypt, but they're not indigenous to Egypt. It's a later import.
I did not actually know that.
Yeah, so you get them in like really early periods, seeming evidence, but they become very difficult to differentiate from sheep in a lot of sculpture that we have. And if you just have a head, it's hard to say if it's a camel or a sheep. There's some evidence for Ramesses II, or is no Ramesses the Great, but probably Ptolemy II introduced them in large numbers. So they're not a dynastic thing at all, like 3,000 years from the unification of Egypt for camels to probably get embedded.
Oh, wow. And I also want to kind of echo back, like you used the term orientalizing. And mm-hmm. I think that that is a very important term for us to talk about now, like at this junction in the conversation, because, you know, first of all, what do you mean by that for people who have not heard the word? And then also, where are we, what kinds of blind spots and interpretive difficulties do our collective orientalizing tendencies create as you're doing this work?
Yeah, that's a big question, especially the second part. So in terms of the term orientalizing, so it comes from the 1970s volume Orientalism by Edward Said. And like in a nutshell, it's about Western approaches, stereotyping of all quote unquote Eastern places, which Egypt is included in that, all the way over to Japan, right? Everything east of really central Europe becomes part of that. And part of it is, yeah, like negative stereotypes broadly. And so in Egypt and Egyptian games, it can be down to the Eastern as other and as bad guys, as tropes, as lazy tropes, as being inferior to the West, as just picking up all of these elements. And so it becomes really, like, for example, mummies is one good example, the othering of the deceased remains of foreign people, treating them as objects, objects for display, objects for not necessarily ridicule, but of dehumanizing groups because they are other to us and therefore can be treated in ways that we would not treat us, our own people. And I don't know if scare quotes, I should actually probably say scare quotes rather than do that on a podcast.
No, actually, you know what? I had never really fully thought of that. That is a really interesting point. I need to like chew on that for a while. But the other thing is, it sounds like, I'd be very interested in verifying if this is true, that most of the focus for Egypt when we're talking about, oh, Egypt and games, is on really particular, I guess not even time periods, like just specific pieces of specific time periods that we can still see all together on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, so the landscape of Egypt that survives today is largely a New Kingdom one. So just very briefly, Egypt is divided by modern historians of Egypt into three main kingdoms: the Old Kingdom, which is the time of the pyramids; the Middle Kingdom, which is probably the least known to lots of non-specialists; and the New Kingdom, which is the time of Tutankhamun, Ramesses the Great. And then you have intermediate periods after each kingdom when Egypt is decentralized, is broken up as foreign rulers. And so kingdoms, you know, are held in, this is another example, I would say, of Orientalism as well. Like kingdoms are strong, ruled by a single monarch, and that is the correct way to rule, right? You know, 19th century is when Egyptology developed, and this is a time of the growth of European empires around the world. often under, if not invariably under, a single monarch. And so projecting ideas of what constitutes the correct way to govern, the what constitutes a strong state, strong kingdom, projecting that onto Egypt, you know. And so the landscape that we see is predominantly a new kingdom one, because they built over on top of what came before. You have people, it's the height of Egyptian wealth, of international influence. And so we see a particular idea of Egypt and, yeah, whether it's Tutankhamun as an idea, you know, the boy king and how famous that is, and his tomb as well, like that color scheme, his mask, the image of Tutankhamun appears so often in, like my own contribution to my book on, to the edited volume, Ancient Egypt and Video Games, is on fighting games. And focusing on a 2D fighting game called Schoolgirls, which has a character, Eliza, that is draws heavily on Egypt in every aspect of it. And deep diving into games, like some older games that you find, it, you know, a character is Egyptian because it's wearing that blue and gold striped headdress, which is on the Tutankhamun mask. And so these images, which become iconic and they're immediately recognizable, that, you know, you can copy and paste them and call character Ramesses or Imhotep, especially after the Mummy 1999 film. You know, some names have really big, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm saying like catchment. It's not catchment, but, you know, recognition factor.
Yeah.
These names have very big recognition factor. And so they become, they multiply and become increasingly recognizable as well, which creates a self-fulfilling circle, because those names then circulate again and again.
So in terms of board games, you mentioned mm-hmm. that you have been playing some board games with your students in class.
Yes.
And you know that you've been interested in sort of board games with Egyptian elements. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, other than like Valley of the Kings and like Ra, I actually don't really know a lot about games about ancient Egypt. You know, I normally focus on the Roman stuff, which yeah. We can come back to that Roman Egypt factor later, because it gets so ignored. Oh, it hurts. Islamic Egypt is even more ignored. It's even yeah. worse, I'd say. But what kinds of availability for different periods, different topics, mm-hmm. like what can you find to use in a classroom that is of use yeah. in the board game world?
And yeah, it's really interesting, because when I first started, that I wanted to pursue this line and to look at historical board game sets, or at least drawing upon ancient Egypt, you know, I'd go Google board games, Egypt, and see what ones pop up. And suddenly you think, oh, there's not that many games. And then obviously that they just catch what's Egypt in the title, all the most famous games. And then suddenly you expand search parameters, or learn how to use Board Game Geek properly in terms of searching for categories, and suddenly all these games get thrown up. So one of the most famous, or one of the best known and most widely played of the past decade or so, is Imhotep, Builder of Egypt, which is, so for those who've only heard of Imhotep as the bad guy in mummy films, Imhotep historically is the architect that designed the first pyramid, the step pyramid of King Djoser in the Third Dynasty. And he was later deified as a god of knowledge and science. And so he's not at all, you know, the scary mummy guy. But Imhotep is, yeah, a competition to build the pyramids. And that's pretty well known. And there are a couple of really big ones now that are in most board game shops that you go into. One is Ankh, Gods of Egypt,
yep.
which was a Kickstarter from a few years ago. And it is immense. Like, literally, the box is huge, and packing all the elements away afterwards is a nightmare. But there's also 3 expansion packs. That's not even including like the Kickstarter exclusives, which go for hundreds of dollars on eBay. And that one is, you know, kind of the Catan hexagonal playing board, and you play god, and the idea is that humans aren't worshipping the gods so much. So you're competing for faith, for support of the gods. So you're basically, it's territory control game as a god. And Come On Games that developed it are a miniature company, and it is beautiful. The figures themselves are absolutely lush, but it's super expensive as a result. As we said, I have to give a shout out to my research center, one of my research centers, ManMet History Research Center, that's actually funded the purchasing of games for research as well. I'm very fortunate to have support from the research environment at university, because when you're looking at £80 for the base game, so what, $90 or thereabouts, plus the expansion pack, you know, once you've bought a couple of board games, that's the cost of a console. They're so expensive and take up so much space. But I played Gods of Egypt with my students. I found YouTube videos explaining the rules, because it's a big rule set, and one of them paid proper attention. So we managed to get into it pretty well. And my two of, yeah, there's so many, it depends on what you want. Like there's that competition for territory. There's resource management, a lot of marketplace games. There are building, which again is taking on resource management largely. So that, I guess, Euro versus American style games. And there's almost something for everyone. There is, I stumbled upon in our big bookshop chain in the UK, Waterstones, a little tile and card game called Cleocatra, I think it is. It's... And I was like, okay, cool. Like, yes, I need to buy this now. Lots of gods really feature heavily. I think, again, going back to like really like the heavy iconicity factor of it, gods, Egypt, animal-headed gods, they have such an immediate recognition factor, as well as pyramids. You get ones which are really lazy, which are basically... I was talking from digital games, say like they're just skinned to look like Egypt, because Egypt is recognition. So it's a market thing, but the actual gameplay and nothing inside the box other than aesthetics is anything to do with Egypt. So it gets used as something maybe to stand out from similar logic games or something else like that. You put Egypt on it and, well, it doesn't, did it for me, right? You know, it's the only reason I've bought it, maybe for different reasons to lots of people. But what I'm interested in terms of games, so I've played a number of games with my second year undergraduates who took my Egyptian unit. I asked if anyone was interested in games for extracurricular points for a system we have at ManMet. And that I was interested in particularly in what games would be good in a classroom environment. So if people were interested in games or in maybe going into teaching after their undergraduate degree to come. And so I've had five students, not always at the same time, play games. So we played Cleopatra and Society of Architects, which I think is a beautiful game. And what I like about it and thinking about teaching is how tactile games are. Nice ones that have got pieces, yeah, makes them expensive, but this one has sphinxes, obelisks, parts of the palace that you build for her, and just that ability to stop, look at the piece, and maybe how that sparks either conversation or something else. And unlike video games, sat and often, you know, they're quite fast and they go on, and you don't have that chance to really, you know, who stops while they're playing a video game to discuss parts of it, you know, it's much harder. But four of you around a table, let alone more kids, to, you know, actually just stop and be like, oh, like, what is this? Like, do you know, like, what's the information you have about it? Do you recognize this god? You know, what did he do? And, oh, what do you think is on this tile, this card? And to start having that dialogue and like explore their knowledge, gaps in knowledge, like how that can be filled, what they're interested in, you know, what really piques their interest, what grabs their attention. And so I think Cleopatra and Society of Architects is great for that. and gods of Egypt are something similar, although they also have little camels to do caravans to break off territory. And the games that didn't go down as well, there's a little market auction type game called Angkor, and the students were like, you know, it's a bit like playing like mini Catan or something, but really quick. And I think because, yeah, it's not tangible, and Egypt isn't obvious other than the box.
Yeah.
And so this search this broad range and seeing kind of what their responses to it as people relatively new to Egypt are. And yeah, I think it's just such a great way to start dialogue. And I think especially in primary schools where teachers don't get given any information really about special subjects and out there to field for themselves, how can, when you're teaching 7-8 year olds, how can games be used as a creative method to encourage learning in different ways as well? And I'm going to sit down, hopefully, actually put this through classrooms, but not just play games, but then hack games as well. Board games are so much easier to hack than, you know, any other medium you're going to use, and modify it, make it easier for 7-8 year olds. You know, most of these big games are for like 10 plus, 14 plus. You know, they're really complex. How can you make games simpler? How do they encourage not just, you know, thinking like strategizing, but communication skills, team play skills? How can you maybe play the game and then get them to write a story afterwards? Like, what was this game? How do you explore that? How do you then spark maybe an interest in something they've seen in that way? So not at that level thinking about like really deep diving hardcore education.
Right.
But yeah, how do they get used in creative ways to really just spark interest and then see where it goes and develop that as over time?
So basically games make a good teaser to kind of get people moving towards a subject area.
Yeah, I think for me, it's not even so much a teaser. You know, if they never want to look at Egypt after it, it's fine. But I think just ways for them to explore a topic in a different way from what they used to, that it's not reading or just writing, you know, the 3 hours and not doing homework in a traditional way. But especially for students that learn in non-traditional ways, whether they have learning support needs or, you know, just, yeah, maybe bored of a topic, you know, how do you just engage them in different ways? Which, yeah, if they like, yeah, that was fun, but can we do it for a topic I'm really interested in? Cool. You know, but, and how can it support teachers to actually have a way that they can set up and a topic, and I can give them information as well, but like how they can use that to support their own teaching when they're not specialists in the area, you know, how can they use that as a, I'm saying prop, it's not a prop, but as a tool and something in the classroom, especially, you know, the 8 year olds, when I go in and talk to them, are fantastic, like so enthusiastic, but I only have to do that for a day, you know, and they do it every day. And I go home after a day and I'm exhausted. And, you know, people who do that every day, you know, day in, day out for 10 months of the year or whatever it is in total, you know, hats off. And how can we support that in ways which, you know, bring in a bit of variety, and you know, they're 8, they should be having fun.
Yeah, I teach 14 to 18 year olds, and I still think that 8 year olds are scary. They're so little.
They have, but so they're not energy. Cynical. Yeah, they've got energy, but they're not cynical, right? Everything is fun, and they just want to demonstrate knowledge and ask questions, questions you've never thought about, because, like, my brain is not wired as an 8 year old's brain, and, you know, how stimulating it is, and it's great. And I don't know if I, you know, in the secondary school going in and working on eco games, I did one session that, you know, they kind of self-select who want to stay for the club. But even then, like, it's not kind of consistently the level of energy as you get in 8 year olds, which, yeah, it's exhausting, but it's really interesting. And for me, like, seeing things in a different way, seeing my own subjects that I've done, you know, for a long time in a different way as well. And I think games can support that in ways that people, you know, people still don't take games seriously in lots of different respects.
Yes. Although I very much think we should, obviously, but I really do. So I'm kind of the other end of the spectrum. You know, we've also been seeing quite the renaissance of games, I think, in academic settings, you know, or maybe not even a renaissance, maybe it's just a full on, like they're hot right now. I'm happy about it. But, you know, we've got things like Reacting to the Past, where people are role playing the past in, you know, these really deep educational ways. You know, this podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University, and they've got the Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And it's, you know, they're doing peer reviewed games that are meant as scholarly objects as well as objects of play. Is anybody doing something like that right now for Egypt?
Not as far as I know. And again, I may be way off the mark, but I think one of the things of Egypt, I think when people maybe think about Egypt as a subject, it's a misconception, you know, because Egypt is so old. It must have been studied for such a long time. But in terms of modern academia, the rediscovery, quote unquote, of Egypt following the Napoleonic mission in, you know, the early, about late 18th and early 19th century, and the scientific mission. Egyptology is a subject which is 200 years old. Like last year was the 200th anniversary of the decipherment by Champollion of the Rosetta Stone. And, you know, we still have so much stuff, one that's been extracted from Egypt in the 19th, early 20th centuries in European and American collections predominantly, excavations that are still going on. Like we have so much material still to be published that moving beyond that, Egyptology is behind in other terms, like the study of classics, like reception studies and classics is a much older discipline. And whether it's cinema as a start, but literature and Egypt in terms of reception studies has really only been gaining ground over the past 20 years. And so there's still a lot of legwork. And in that, you know, it always starts with the most famous film, literature, video games has the past decade been starting, well, not starting, like Dunstan Lowe's been publishing, no, for decades or more, but it's been really been gaining ground since, I guess, around 2016 and Chapman's book, and then a number of other volumes, edited volumes, have come out in the past 4 years, really. And in that, Egypt, because of Assassin's Creed Origins, has been on the fringe, but people are just starting to do more on that, but we don't really have... like tradition is not as strong yet in Egyptology. So once, you know, popular ones and everything else starts coming, and board games is the black hole, I think, because of access. They're a lot less accessible. The online resources are not as strong. You know, the number of wiki pages for video games which are 30 plus years old that, you know, have either been ported to whatever, you know, you can play all these Atari 80s games on ports, including some Egypt ones. But board games are much harder. Plus, inherently, they need people to play with. You know, you can play board games by yourself, and some board games, you know, are designed for one plus players. And I've tried the one player ones, and it's just, you know, it's like, okay, cool, I've lost.
How dare you? This is the Beyond Solitaire podcast, Jenny.
I know, but I guess also the kind of Egypt games. You know, there's a game called Run, 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 which is a dungeon escape game with tiles, which you play as Kat, Indiana Jones kind of characters.
Oh my gosh, it's so cute.
And the bad guy is Tutankhamun, because, you know, you need the historic cats versus dogs. And so the mummies are dogs, the heroes are cats, and you have to go, and you've got tiles. So every time you play, the game is, it's random board generation. And I played it by myself, and yeah, the look of the tiles, I got killed by the mummy pretty quickly in terms of the timing. And I was like, okay, what do I do now? Do I go again or wait to play with other people? And so, yeah, board games, I think, have a number of challenges to people in terms of research. But then I think the affordances of board games over other media, you know, have so much more to offer. And thinking about reception studies from box art to the text on the back of the box, to the rule book, to rule books which like couch a little bit of historical context, to the pictures, the artwork that accompanies that, to the board itself, if the game has a board or how that is, to pieces, to meeples, to tokens, to cards, like everything that surrounds it, the ability to argue over the rules, because, you know, those board game rules are not always as intuitive as maybe all designers think they are, but they kind of what that discussion in the spaces allows. And I mentioned before, like, hacking with school kids, but also, like, okay, how do I make this game do X or Y? How can I explore? How can I adapt it to maybe think of different questions? And I think there's so many affordances, but those take time. You know, I can sit down and churn out for hours at night, you know, a pretty big action adventure game, take screenshots on my PlayStation because I'm a console, not a PC gamer. And, you know, I have then all of my evidence from that gameplay. Sometimes make notes, sometimes replay it, but I don't need to set up or do anything. I just need to switch on a machine and, you know, no one's going to tell me to go to bed, so I can, you know, sit there, play the video game for as long as I want. But board games require, I think, more patience, and I think more dedication in many ways to actually extract the information from them that you want.
That is really, I'm taking this under advisement, just as somebody who started to design historical board games. This is super interesting, but we have limited time. So I do want to ask, so you mentioned Assassin's Creed Origins multiple times in this interview, just as sort of a watershed moment for bringing gaming and Egypt together. So how is Assassin's Creed Origins as a game that depicts ancient Egypt? Yeah. And then I guess that's a twin question too. You know, what kinds of things has it brought back? And then what is still in the dark after a game like that?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, how is it as a game? And I was going to be like, well, you know, not get into the game play. So I had never previously played an Assassin's Creed game. I wasn't interested in the series. My dad, as well as other friends, are big Assassin's Creed fans. But then when Origins came out, and actually how I got my copy, I was reflecting on this earlier, was a friend was working an event in Copenhagen that was involving Ubisoft, and they gave her a copy of the game. It's not in a box. It looks like it's like a dodgy copy. It's not. It's Ubisoft copy, but it must be their traveling one. So it's just in a little CD case. And they gave it to her, and she's like, oh, yeah, like, what console do you play on, like, PS4? She's like, do you want Assassin's Creed? It's like, sure, I'll have a crack. So I didn't even pay for it. You know, it was given to me. So I sat down and explored, and I was, like, suddenly struck by, obviously, how beautiful the game is, right? It's a AAA company. It looks beautiful. But I was really taken with a lot of really interesting things they do, you know, spatially, how they adapt the game, the Egypt for the game mechanics. And so I don't think accuracy is important, right? Because you have other concerns. I like how they make old stuff ancient compared to, like, contemporary sites which are being used, how they imagine temple spaces to be used. Yeah, you could be there and say, no, priests wouldn't be sat on chairs because that's not what they were doing. They sat cross-legged on the ground. You can go and nitpick through this. But I think just spatially how they conceptualize houses, what insides of houses look like, family composition. I'm currently for another project, which I don't know if I'm allowed to name it, but being asked to write about children in Egypt-based video games. And that's a really hard thing because children don't figure full stop in a lot of video games. And so Origins is going to be the go-to there as well, but like how they become how they're presented, the kind of roles they fulfill in the game as NPCs in terms of both background but also side quests, and the kind of way they fit into that world. I think it's interesting how when Bayek has to find, so Bayek, for those who haven't played it, being the main protagonist that you control together with his wife, Aya, when Bayek finds some big stealer, he goes, "Oh, stealer from the old kingdom," which, as I mentioned before, is an entirely modern concept, right? No Egyptian is going to think of that. He may think in dynasties at that time, because those have been established a few centuries earlier by the priest Manito, but, you know, not this one. Like, how, so yeah, I really like how, like, spatially it's reimagined. Is it a perfect representation? Like, how do you judge that, right? You know, it's ultimately a piece of entertainment. Although, saying that, with the Discovery Tour and Ubisoft selling it as a big part of, like, edutainment and the education side, you know, then it has to be held to a different standard from games that don't claim any educational content. And I think it's really interesting, and the level of details, like, you know, because all the optional, you can stop and read stuff. And some of the letters, remember one in one of the downloadable content games on the DLC packages in the Sinai, there's a letter from Cicero. And I took a screenshot and I was like, "Hey, Romanist friends, is this an actual letter?" And on Facebook, a number of them had a debate, and one said, "Yes, it's this." And he's not a gamer at all, but he recognized the Cicero passage. And so, you know, this level of details, which are incidental. I hate reading all the side bits. Like, my dad actually reads everything. You know, he's probably the person this should be intended for. But, you know, that level of detail, I think, is really remarkable in it. And so I think there's lots of starting off points. And I did use, I know, as running out of time, but as in a first year lecture a few years ago before the pandemic, I only had 6 weeks to talk about, to introduce ancient Egypt as part of a bigger survey course.
Oh, that's so tight.
Yeah, it's not nice. But in the pyramid one, I used a screenshot from the Discovery Tour when they look at the step pyramid, and they have the watercolor reconstructed drawings from Gauvin, a French archaeologist, is like lots of recreation of ancient sites. And so now on the screen, I've got the screenshot from my PlayStation with the user interface, the text that Ubisoft have added in, but then this painting watercolor in the background, because it's such a good recreation, but also to highlight kind of places where you can find this information. And the student after the lecture said, "Yeah, but, like, come on, really, is Assassin's Creed good for anything?" It's like, you know, in Discovery Tour, they have archival material, they have Egyptian artifacts, or like they worked with, you know, the Louvre, the British Museum, the Met. Some of the images, the resolution on the game is better than on the online catalogs. And so, you know, it's this really interesting mix and balance. And I think if you use it critically, you know, drawing attention, but the kind of questions you can do and not be like, "How accurate is this?" But having students acknowledge, okay, it's going to change because it's a game. But, okay, not just this isn't what is in Egypt. Okay, why is it not? What is actually there? Why is it different? Can you see kind of how you get from A to B in these changes? And so kind of discuss that process and then the creative processes that reimagine that landscape for a different setting. And I think that's, for me, the most interesting thing about games are the spaces in between and how you use those spaces for discussion, for debate, for just thinking about a subject and allowing you to see your subject in a different way that can expand your own horizons and your own way of thinking about a subject that goes beyond traditional, conventional academic practice.
You know what? We could keep going, but I'm going to take that as a perfect sum up because that was really good. And so I'll just ask softy questions instead. But I really want to continue this conversation over time, and I want to see that volume. What are you playing for fun right now that's bringing you joy?
I'm in between. I'm actually talking about games which have Egypt as a not so much accidental, but not main part. There is a mobile game called Diggy's Adventure where the whole first section is based in Egypt. So I've been slightly addicted to that on my iPad to try and get all the stuff to uncover all the Egypt levels. But I've been between games, and the next game I want to play for fun, but I will have to buy a PS5, is Final Fantasy 16.
Excellent. Very Egyptian. Perfect. And if people want to follow your work, where should they find you?
So I have a couple of places. So on Instagram, I have playing_Egypt, which is where I post predominantly about board games, but not only. And then I'm not going to use its new name, on Twitter and also Instagram and Threads, I am Papyrus_stories, which is the other aspect of my research. And I pop up on the now name of the center is the Manchester Game Center website, book reviews, blogs. I've got some interviews, hopefully, but typed interviews coming up with different people who've been working on games or these pop culture in different capacities. So that's a place. Plus all of my other awesome Manchester colleagues have been working on games in all kinds of shapes and sizes.
Awesome. Awesome. And so for those of you who are out there, I can be found anywhere as Beyond Solitaire. I'm forever online. So that's easy. But Jenny, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an awesome conversation. I feel like I learned a lot, and I hope that the listeners did too.
Thank you so much, Liz, for inviting. And yeah, I hope between somewhere that there's something for everybody to pick a little nugget out.
Absolutely. But thank you again. And those of you who are out there, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.